Hello, this is episode 37 of This Week with David Rovix. How do you strangle a corporation? Some of my more regular listeners may be tired of hearing about the fact that the rent on my apartment in Portland, Oregon has more than doubled since I moved to the city 12 years ago. But as President Trump fires half his staff because they're basically not fascist enough, I must return to the doubling of my rent because it is the living room elephant. One pollster I heard yammering on the radio one day said that the single factor that most effectively represented, in a nutshell, Trump's base of support were people whose standards of living had decreased over the previous 10 years. One of the main reasons for the marked decrease in quality of life for so many people in the U.S. and many other countries, especially since around the turn of the millennia, has been the skyrocketing cost of housing. How easy is it to say, we're full, and then blame the most recent refugees and immigrants on the lack of affordable housing? Is it any surprise that this would happen? Did the wrecking ball deregulators of the housing market intentionally encourage a rightward xenophobic shift in politics in order to distract attention from their ever more cannibalistic tendencies, as increasingly the billionaires and hedge fund managers don't invest in the volatile stock market, but in the housing market? That is, they invest in the human need to keep a roof over our heads. They bank on the notion that as long as most people somehow manage to be resourceful enough to keep paying the ever-increasing rents, they can keep on getting a return on their investment. Until when? When every year the rents rise several times as much as wages do, when is the breaking point? For many years now, I've been wondering, trying to answer the perennial question, how do you strangle a corporation? Unable to answer the question myself, I took to asking audiences at my concerts. I think it was in Olympia that someone answered, one at a time. It's not good enough, though. All of the songs I wrote about strangling my landlord helped my mental state temporarily, but as the rent continued to increase, these moments of creative catharsis became ever more fleeting. What we need are solutions. Both songs and arson may have their place, but then so do band-aids. Meanwhile, the solutions exist, and they're easy. They just require that the state not be controlled by real estate developers. Because when people other than real estate developers or other money-grubbing pond scum are in power, then there's the prospect of actual democracy taking place. This can potentially involve legislatures imposing things like rent control. In the U.S., this is entirely within the purview of state legislatures to do, but the vast majority of them have instead banned the practice over the past several decades, making sure that municipalities cannot pass their own local rent control ordinances. In the U.S., the movement against gentrification is frankly pathetic. Nowhere are there ever sustained or large protests, housing occupations, or rent strikes. All of these things have happened in the past in the U.S., but that was a long time ago. I am a proud member of a tenants' union in Portland, but it is an anemic organization, bereft of popular participation, funds, or most anything else aside from a handful of dedicated, enthusiastic, and often stressed-out organizers. I'd suggest that the reason for the fact that when we have protests in Portland or Salem, we're lucky if attendance is in the triple digits, is twofold. It doesn't help at all that most of the media is about 100 times more interested in covering Trump and anti-Trump than in covering basically anything else, especially if it's an issue like housing, which directly affects the billionaires and investors who own most of the media. Much safer to cover Trump and anti-Trump, along with supplementary team sporting events, always skimming the surface of any exploration of the actual policies lying beneath the rants. Whether the refugee children are put in cages or not does not affect the bottom line of the real estate developers, speculators, and investors that quietly dominate so many of our lives. The other main reason for our sad little protests is we profoundly lack optimism in the possibility that we might actually reverse course rather than just slow down the inevitable. Buried in the headlines, very intentionally, I'm sure, among many other intentionally buried or otherwise horrifically misreported stories, is the growing movement against the trend of ever-increasing rents and ever-increasing corporate profits in Berlin. In Berlin, protests against gentrification, such as the one last weekend, involved tens of thousands of people in the street. This would be a decent crowd for a national or even international protest there, but this is mainly just Berliners. Like Portland, Berlin was recently a city full of artists and cafes and vibrant communities of all sorts, where rent was cheap and life was full of possibility. That all changed in Portland, and it's been changing in Berlin too. But unlike in Portland, where rent used to be cheap because the economy wasn't good enough to support many people who could afford to pay high rents, the city of Berlin, both east and west, remained affordable for so long because the lion's share of the housing was public, owned by the government. Hundreds of thousands of units were sold to private corporations in recent decades in Berlin, and the result has been gentrification and rapidly rising rents, largely imposed by corporate conglomerates that have absolutely no interest in sustainable community or human rights, but only in the bottom line for their wealthy investors from places like New York, London, and Oslo. This is exactly what's been happening in Seattle, San Francisco, and Portland. But unlike our straggly group, often outnumbered by the politicians within the building we're protesting outside of, to say nothing of their staff, Berlin is rising up. There are many explanations for this difference, but chief among them is the fact that Berlin has a recent history of great, widespread, and inexpensive public housing. People in Berlin, and more broadly in Germany, as well as in many other countries, generally grew up with the notion that the government, again, both in the East and in the West, has a responsibility to adequately house the citizens of the country. It has long been understood there to be part of the social contract, why we have a government. Someday, maybe we'll relearn this lesson in the United States. In the meantime, may the people of Berlin please show the world how to properly strangle a landlord when the landlord is a faceless corporation. Socialize their property for the common good.
The patroons came from Holland to America, became landlords where none had been before. Soon one man owned 500,000 acres on both sides of the Hudson River shore. He invited families to move in and give him 30% of everything they grew every year. This is how they'd pay the rent. His name was Van Rensselaer. He became one of the richest men on earth. In today's terms, $90 billion is how much he'd be worth. All this for doing nothing, but saying all of this was his. I have the power of the state behind me, and I'm in the landlord biz. After 200 years of this, and one revolution won, another Van Rensselaer had another son. And this Rensselaer was greedier than his ancestors dead and past. It was the 1840s, and things were changing fast. It was the straw that broke the back. The bottle was uncorked. They started organizing meetings, the tenant farmers of New York. They found the strength of numbers. They found the power of suggestion. They found each other asking the same question. Who gave you the right to be a landlord? To live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? They vowed they would stop the rent collection. They vowed they'd bring this madness to an end. And when one blew the tin horn of distress, he soon found he had 1,000 friends. With calico skirts, masks upon their faces, on horseback, armed with knives and guns. They chanted and they yelled, they kept their farms, and they kept the sheriffs on the run. They asked, who gave you the right to be a landlord? To live a life of ease while others toil? Right to be a rich man while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil.
The governor's militias tried to stop them, but nothing could be done to break their will. And by 1848, the landlords buckled, sold their holdings to the farmers in the hills. Yes, they overthrew this feudal system, but it's replaced now by speculators and banks. And you can still hear the homeless families asking of all the landed gentry in our ranks, who gave you the right to be a landlord, to live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man, while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? Who gave you the right to be a landlord, to live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man, while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? Who gave you the right?
This has been episode 37 of This Week with David Rovics. Unfortunately, they don't tend to go out of date, so if you want to hear the other 36 episodes, you can find them at davidrovics.com/thisweek or on all the usual podcasting platforms, including Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and YouTube. In written form, it goes out every week as a column in Dissident Voice and on my blog at davidrovics.com/thisweek. You can also listen to the podcast or read the column every week on the David Rovics mobile app, which is available for both Apple and Android. I'll be home in Portland for most of the rest of this month, and then I'm back in Scandinavia for a week. I'll mainly be in Denmark to play at several May 1st events, but I have dates free just before and after May 1st if anyone in Denmark or nearby parts of Sweden might be inclined to organize anything. Okay, hope to see you next week here in Podcastville. Bye for now.